Hi, welcome to the Arizona State Sports and Entertainment Law Journal's podcast. Today's guest is Aaron Hernandez. Aaron is the director of the Bud Selig Sports Law and Business Program at Arizona State University. Aaron is a lawyer, has also worked with the NCAA, and now currently runs the program here at ASU and is very supportive of our program. And yeah, we're happy to have you on. Thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me, Brandon.
So, you know, this is a, you know, sports and entertainment focused journal, as you're aware. Can you just tell us a little bit about your background and like where you got to where you are now? Starting with undergrad, law school, and I might interrupt you along the way, so just be prepared.
Feel free to at any point. First, thanks for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate you and everything you do for the Sports and Entertainment Law Journal. Name's Aaron Hernandez, unfortunately named Aaron Hernandez. I'm trying to rewrite the narrative.
Is there anybody else named Aaron Hernandez?
But believe it or not, Google search, you'll find an Aaron Hernandez, who, by the way, was also involved with football for a while. So, trying to rewrite the narrative on Aaron Hernandez. So I'm originally from El Paso, Texas, born and raised there, left back in 2006 when I graduated high school and went to the University of Notre Dame up in South Bend, Indiana. Was there for 4 years, played in the band, played in the marching band there for the Band of the Fighting Irish. And that's where I got my initial itch in, to work in sports, doing my stuff in the band on game days, on football weekends, and we got to travel all over the place with the basketball team and really fell in love with college sports. And at some point there at Notre Dame, I decided that my major was finance, and I decided I was going to be an investment banker because of all the money they make. And then I found out what their life was like, and I said, you know what? I don't want to be an investment banker anymore. And so instead of making a bunch of money after paying a bunch of loans to go to this private school out in the Midwest, I decided, you know what, I'm going to incur more loans and do the equal amount of work and not get that money and go to law school instead. And the reason for going to law school is I thought it was my best route into sports. I figured out at some point in college I wanted to work in sports. I thought at the time, not really having many connections in the sports industry, that the only route to do that was agency. I met a sports agent at my time there at Notre Dame. His daughter was interested in our school, and I worked in admissions. And we got to talking. He was Jimmy Sexton's right-hand man for his former agency, which used to be called Athletic Resource Management. And so me and his name's Rick Landrum ended up forging a relationship, and Rick became my de facto law school advisor. You know, I'm the first generation attorney in the family, and so I didn't really have any guidance, and so Rick kind of served as my guidance. And when looking to go to law school, I told him, I want to be like you. I want to work in sports. And Rick said, okay, well, you really have two options in that case, either Marquette up in Milwaukee or Tulane down in New Orleans. And really, I'd go to Marquette. Now, I really never thought about these places at all. To my familiarity with Tulane was Katrina had just recently happened, and I know that it wrecked their stadium. And so that was my familiarity with Tulane. Marquette used to play in the Big East, and so we would play them in basketball. That was my familiarity with Marquette. Like, I wasn't even quite sure where Marquette was. I don't know where Milwaukee, Wisconsin was. And so I went through the law school application process and started getting in to a bunch of places, luckily, and more highly ranked places. And I told Rick, like, I got to go to, you know, one of these other schools that I'd gotten into. And he was very certain. He said, if you want to work in sports, Aaron, this is where you need to go. And he was very certain about Marquette. So ultimately, I followed Rick's advice and stayed around in the terrible Midwest weather for another 3 years, and went to Marquette and was part of their National Sports Law Institute, and ended up having a really robust experience there in law school, and it helped me figure out what I wanted to do going into sports.
So when you started at Marquette, you knew that you wanted to go into sports.
Yes, sir.
Did you have a specific path? I mean, you mentioned sports agent, thinking that would be your only way in. But at what point did you find that there are many avenues with a JD degree to get into different kind of, you know, offices, whether it's front office, whether it's being an agent or GM or whatever it is? At what point did you find that?
Pretty early on. You know, I thought the only path that existed was Jerry Maguire's. Literally, that it sounds like a little bit of like a joke, but that was my frame of reference.
Did you ever practice that slogan, like, in the mirror?
No. In fact, when I got there, I figured out pretty quickly also, oh, sports agency is not for me, you know, which is ironic. But immediately, the cool thing about going to a place where they had a focus on sports law was finding these different paths and just even being able to see the menu of options. They're not all that well advertised. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to it later. We talk about, you know, I ended up at the NCAA, but, you know, I remember my 1L year at Marquette, the 30 for 30 Pony Access came out, which details the SMU death penalty and everything that surrounds it. And it ultimately kind of influenced at least the entry point for me in my sports career. And I remember being enthralled by this documentary, but I never even thought about being an NCAA investigator, that was even a career option. How do you get there? What's the path to that? It didn't even cross my mind. And I think one thing that helped tremendously with this program focusing on this subject matter and the overall school supporting it academically was that there are people full-time that work there that spend time with students on exactly this, you know? You just don't have to be an agent to get in sports. You can do all these other myriad of things. And pretty quickly, I was able to start at least weighing those options. Hmm. And found out, I was able to cross one off, too, really quickly. I don't want to be a sports agent. I know that, you know? And it helps to know what you don't want to do in addition to what you're trying to figure out what you want to do.
Sure. How early did you kind of start getting involved in kind of programs? I mean, here at ASU and in multiple, you know, different law schools around the country, there's like clinics or internships. Did you have any opportunities like that while you were in law school? And how did you get those opportunities?
Yeah. So, again, the National Sports Law Institute, which is based out of Marquette's law school, so they focus on all the time, you know, and so whether it's through class or scholarship, like writing, or more practically internship/externships, you know, you can get involved pretty quickly right away. The other thing they have a big support from is your alumni going back and speaking there. And so I, even as a 1L, you know, when you don't have your coursework is already set out for you, and you don't have the opportunity to take these electives, and you're sitting in torts or contracts, and you're trying to figure out, like, how does this apply to my life long term? I don't care about these things, right? You know, you're getting to go to some of these speaker events and network with these folks. They have this big conference they put on where a lot of their alums come in, or they bring industry professionals in. You're able to network and start at a fairly young age. And I'll dovetail into what my first opportunity was, which I think kind of broke the seal on me in sports, which is that elusive first full-time sports internship. There's a, it's called the Diversity Internship Program at NASCAR. And between first semester of 1L year and second semester of 1L year, I started working for the Sun Bowl back home in a volunteer capacity just to put something on my resume. I looked something sports related, but I was also working on this application to NASCAR in that program. And there was no legal option in there. And so I just put my name in the hat, kind of threw up the Hail Mary, and I didn't hear anything for a while. And it was a matter of like months later that I got a call from an area code that was Daytona Beach, Florida. And sure enough, the girl who was in charge of running this internship program said, "Hey, I saw your materials," I'm like 2 months ago, "and thought you might be a good fit with us. But we don't have any legal, we don't have any formally legal position with us," which I knew when I filled out the application, that was not an option. I said, "Okay, I'm just trying to get into sports. I'm trying to get that first piece of experience." And she said, "Well, would you be interested in working in legal?" I said, "Absolutely, I would be." And so the woman who was the deputy general counsel at the time at NASCAR, her name is Karen Leetow. She's now the general counsel for U.S. Soccer. She wanted to participate in this program, and she found my application. They interviewed me, and voila, my first summer internship working with a sports organization full-time was being NASCAR's legal clerk, and it was an outstanding experience. And not only did I learn a lot that summer in between 1L and 2L year, but that first experience, it opened doors later on for more competitive internships and externships. People would at least look when they're looking at your resume, it would catch their eye. Oh, wow, he worked for NASCAR. And I found myself the next round of hiring, getting more looks for these bigger organizations. And so I think that was probably my entry point into, not probably, it was my entry point into the sports world.
Sure. Then you had to use the contracts and torts.
I did. I will admit that I think I even took my contracts casebook with me and my outline, and it actually came in handy a couple of times, redlining for the first time. I will say for people listening to this podcast that, real world writing and what they teach you in the classroom is a little different. And I was I was trying to go off my memos, from first year legal writing. And I remember the attorney just blasting my first draft, being like, "Nobody writes like this. Where did you learn this?" And I was like, "Oh, that's great. I paid a bunch of money to learn how to write like this," Right. But wonderful experience. Wonderful experience.
Okay. So you finish up at Marquette. Did you have a job lined up, before you graduated?
I did, luckily.
Okay. And what was that?
It was the NCAA postgraduate internship position. Okay. In fact, I had an interview for that job on March 13th, 2013. The reason I remember that is my dad's birthday. And I was during spring break, and I had to fly from El Paso up to Indy to do this interview. And one other thing that I've always been interested in is service to our country. And I had an interview on the same day with Air Force JAG at Holloman Air Force Base in New Mexico with I think it was the lieutenant colonel there. And they were both on the same day. Couldn't be in Alamogordo, New Mexico and Indianapolis, Indiana at the same time. So I had to pick. And it was a little tougher than I ever anticipated, especially since I went to school for sports, because the JAG Corps really appealed to me in a different way. And ultimately, after praying about it, I kind of landed on, well, this is the reason I came here. I should go down this road first, mm-hmm. and exhaust this possibility. If not, I could always try JAG in service to our country at some other time. And so, yeah, that was kind of a fork in my road, and I interviewed for the postgraduate internship position and was lucky to get it. And so that last half of my spring semester, 3L year, I had some clarity as to what I was going to be doing right after law school.
Okay, great. Yeah, I mean, there's also a Tom Cruise movie about being in JAG, too.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Whatever avenue you chose.
Just following Tom's footsteps.
Exactly. So you worked with the NCAA after law school. How long were you there?
Ultimately, it was almost 7 years.
Okay. And what was your role there?
So the first couple months, I was the intern, or I was one of the interns in enforcement. And I was very fortunate to be the beneficiary of some bad circumstances. The NCAA's enforcement arm had come under a lot of scrutiny for some cases that were botched, I guess, in the public eyes. And one of them was the Miami case. This is the case dealing with Nevin Shapiro. And the fallout of that case was that some people got fired, some people resigned, and there was a general exodus from the department, and the department was being close to being outsourced. There was a call from member institutions to outsource the department because they weren't too happy with the job that the department was doing. And so when I got there, it was extremely turbulent. There was a lot of empty desks, and you just kind of got the feeling, like, is this place going to go out of business soon? And the silver lining in that for me, which was a huge silver lining, was that somebody that they would have hired full-time into my position, which was with the football group, that was the position I transitioned into. I became the assistant director of football after being an intern. When they were going through the hiring for that position, usually they would hire somebody with 10, 15 years of experience, a lot of times former coaches or been practicing law. And in the middle of this search, my good friend and mentor, Derek Crawford, he printed out the description and brought it over to me. I'm like 3 months on the job right now. This guy used to work at the NFL, former FBI agent, and now he's the managing director of investigations. And he said, you need to apply to this. And I look at it, and it says at least 5-10 years experience. I tell Derek, I don't even have 5-10 months of internship experience. He said, I don't care. Like, we know your work product. Like, just go for it. And so luckily, given the bad situation there at the NCAA at the time, and me being in the right place, the right time, was able to capitalize. They gave me a shot. I think they were hiring so much unknown at the time that they at least had some sense of my work product, and was able to parlay that into a full-time position.
What are some of the challenges that you had in that role? It could be legal related. It doesn't have to be, but you know, things that, you know, you didn't expect to confront, but then have to.
Sure. I mean, my youth was a huge one. Huge one. You know, when you walk into a room and you have to interview a coach who's not used to being challenged or told no, and they see you and you look like me at 25, 26 at the time. I mean, that's your first initial hurdle. Like, they're just sizing you up, and they don't really think that you're, I don't know, prepared to do your job, which you can correct really quickly, by the way, in the interview. But that was a challenge. I think getting some of my, you know, again, very fortunate to cut that line and be in that position at a younger age, but getting some of my strategic points across to people who were older than me was a little bit of an uphill push, because, you know, it's like this kid that's coming up with this stuff, and I knew I was right about these things. You know, I knew, gosh, I've done like the most work and research on this case, and I know my stuff here, but why won't they listen to some of my strategic moves or recommendations? Why aren't they just like taking it at face value? And
right,
and so that, I think, it was an initial frustration of, again, being bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and wanting to change the world. And we can get into it later about why I wanted to do this job. But changing things at a pretty rigid organization like the NCAA, which is like, it's like a governmental organization, is a lot of like, hey, this is just how we've done things for a while, so this is how we're going to continue to do them. Felt a little bit like a fish out of water. You try to push some things that, again, were being a change agent there was tough.
Sure.
It was really, really hard. And I've persevered through some of that stuff to try to get my points across, but you really had to pick your battles, and otherwise you'd zap all your energy. And so I guess they all come back to youth, and particularly for this position, since it was football focused. I didn't play college football. So that's always a little bit of a challenge. But I think that one was way more easily overcome than the other ones I mentioned.
Sure. So you mentioned bright-eyed and bushy-tailed as far as, like, and affecting kind of change. One, did you find that kind of, like, change that you wanted to affect, and what was that like?
Yeah, and just for the record, I feel like I'm still a little bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. not curmudgeon-y yet. I'm still very, very optimistic about life. But, yeah, so, you know, the reason that I wanted to do that job, which was be an enforcement agent or staff member focusing on college football, were events from my time in law school, actually. And one of the first big events that occurred that set me down this path was my 1L year, right after I had graduated from Notre Dame. There was a coaching change there at Notre Dame. So old ball coach Charlie Weiss had been fired. He was the coach when I was there 4 years, and Brian Kelly was hired. And there were these two incidents that were pretty heartbreaking that happened immediately under his watch. And Notre Dame's response to them was not great, you know, and I'm putting that nicely just because we're recorded right now. But as an alum, it was just very disheartening. And one of the incidents was there was a former classmate of mine, named Declan Sullivan. He was a videographer for the football team. And there was a practice one day during the fall. It was in October of 2010. And they had these scissor lifts on the practice field. I'm sure you've seen those skyjacks. And they sent him up in the skyjack to record practice. And this day, there was this front going through the Midwest that was causing these awful tornado speed winds whipping through the Midwest. And so they sent Declan up there to make the story a whole lot shorter. The thing tipped over. He was tweeting from up there, by the way. Like, there's these tweets, and they're kind of horrific to see, because mm-hmm. they're right before he died, where he's mentioning how scared he is being in that position. The lift tipped over. He cracked his head on the on the pavement. Was pronounced dead on the way to the hospital. Just absolutely horrendous. Oh, wow. Why they had him up there in the first place? You know, I guess you could buy Notre Dame's story if you want. I certainly don't. To me, it was a classic case of gross negligence and them failing their duty to care for this young man. And so the response is what was even more disheartening. Their current athletic director, who's a lawyer by trade, I remember him getting up at the podium. His name's Jack Swarbrick. And Jack started talking about this day that Declan died as being this, I remember him using the term, unremarkable. It was unremarkable, and then this freak gust of wind came in, and nobody could have foreseen this. It was a windy day, by the way. I was living in Milwaukee. The whole Midwest was experiencing this front, by the way. It was not an unremarkable day with this freak gust of wind. Like, there was a reason that this 60-mile-an-hour gust came through. And I remember just sitting there as an alum of a place that I loved so much, listening to this guy who graduated from there, was also a lawyer, and I'm sitting in law school taking tours at the time, by the way, thinking he's setting himself up for a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
That's so depressing, because Declan's dead, and I would think that Declan's life and being a member of the Notre Dame community is so much more important than whatever the Sullivan family decides to hit our university with. Like, it was so disheartening. And one, there was protection of the university, and two, there was some major pillars being put around Brian Kelly, because he was this new shiny coach. Notre Dame football needed to get back to success, and ultimately nobody was held accountable for anything.
Wow.
There was a fine that Indiana's Occupational Health and Safety Board levied on the school, and it was I think it was $100,000, which, by the way, doesn't even come close to my tuition total from being there. And they appealed the fine, the gall to appeal the fine. And nobody was fired. Nobody was suspended. Nobody was reprimanded. And it was so sad to me. And to me, reading between the lines, it's like, you got this shiny new football coach. You need to keep him protected. And I thought, somebody's got to hold him accountable. Somebody's got to hold him accountable for being, he's responsible for this, right? Like, Declan was not in a position to protest, right? And say, I can't be up here. Like, he probably lost his job as a videographer. That's a dream position, you know, these cultures and these football programs. It's very top-down, rigid, military style. Declan couldn't defend himself, and nobody held Brian Kelly or anybody on that staff responsible for what would have amounted to gross negligence.
Mm-hmm.
Really quickly, there was another incident earlier in the year where a woman at her sister college, she had alleged she was raped by a football player. His name was Prince Shembo, and her name was Lizzie. Lizzie didn't end up getting her case heard because she committed suicide, and the investigation into her alleged rape didn't start until 10 days after she had killed herself. Again, Prince Shembo didn't miss a single game while he was at Notre Dame, and Lizzie's dead, just like Declan. Similarly, the next year was, everybody's probably way more familiar with this, listening to this podcast. The next year was Joe Paterno, Jerry Sandusky,
mm-hmm.
these awful things that occurred over the course of years, and these young boys being abused in the showers on campus. But you can't mess with Penn State football, and you can't mess with Notre Dame football. And I just thought to myself, my gosh, like, these guys need to be held accountable, and I'm going to do that. And in our positions at the NCAA, luckily, like, not having to report to that person, who usually there's nobody more powerful than the head football coach, or if you're at a basketball school, the head basketball coach on campus. And they usually don't have anybody questioning them, including the president and the athletic director in many cases. But I could, and I had no problem posting them up. Sorry to use the pun, but posting them up on some of these things. And a lot of times they're more NCAA violation related. We're not getting to the cases of, like, murder and rape and things like this, which eventually I did get to, unfortunately, in my career. But I always thought, you know, if you can't do these simple things right, you can't follow these rules of the NCAA right, and you're okay with moral relativism and, you know, kind of squirming your way out of personal responsibility, I extrapolate that and forecast that to you and what you are like morally as a human being, and, like, do you really need to be the leader of young men?
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to hold these guys accountable. And largely, I was able to at least help with that. And we also, I focused on a lot of negative right there, but we had so many good coaches in the NCAA, so many great football, and I focused on football, so many great football coaches. You know, Lincoln Riley at OU and his predecessor, Bob Stoops, who was just, mm-hmm. you know, he was gold. He was gold to me and to his players. I mean, they loved them. Coach Kingsbury, who's now here with the Arizona Cardinals, I mean, nobody loved their coach more than Texas Tech football players. Matt Rhule at Baylor, Gary Patterson. I mean, the list goes on. There were so many good ones, but in order to keep those good ones doing their job how we needed them to be doing it, we needed to have a group of hardened cops, and I considered myself to be one of those cops who held the others accountable for all the bad that they did.
Sure. So now you're holding different people accountable in your current role. So what kind of, you know, to transition a little bit, what took you from the NCAA to come to Arizona State to run this program here?
You know, when I was working directly in sports, which was, you know, in my previous role, I got to meet a lot of different industry executives, not only in college sports, but in professional sports and at national governing bodies. And, you know, I was very blessed in my previous role. I would fly 120 times a year because a big part of my job was relationship management.
Lots of miles.
Right, lots of miles. Lots of miles. American, by the way, which I'm not getting to use any of them this year, but I will eventually. But I got to meet just a ton of people and create this big Rolodex, and that was a big blessing. And one of the things that I learned pretty quickly was, gosh,